Cat Mayo Hour.
Welcome to the Pat Mayo Hour, continuing our series on daily fantasy football strategy, whether it be DraftKings, whether it be FanDuel, whether it be somewhere else. Today we are focusing solely on tournament play, GPPs, and frankly, giant GPPs, multi-entry tournaments. Maybe we'll get to some single entries and some smaller tournaments a little bit later on. If you want to check out my chat on cash games and bankroll management, I suggest you go look and search for the Pat Mayo Drew Dinkmeyer breakdown. That came out earlier this week. It was really good stuff, and if you are wondering how to allocate your bankroll to try to build progressively, not try to hit big all at one time and have sustained success, I really encourage everyone to go listen to it. But today, we got Al Smith on the line, and we're going to try to figure out if we can win some big bucks in some of these tournaments and some of the tips and tricks and how to do it. What's going on, Al?
Not much. That was quite an intro. I'm always impressed by your skills on the mic, Pat.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I mean, for all anyone knows, you heard, like, round one of what's going on, and I've recorded this intro, like, 800 times now.
Exactly.
Although I'm going to leave 800 in just to make sure that, you know, the people know that I'm not editing stuff out.
Of course. It's movie magic in the making, but just live.
Exactly. So I think the first thing that, and this is something that I really struggle with, too, because I want to win a lot of money. So I see a millionaire maker out there. I'm like, oh, man, $1 million to first prize. Let me enter that. That seems to be a bad idea if you want to have continued success. What, in terms of game selection, do you really look for when it comes to tournaments?
Well, my favorite tournaments are the ones that have a flatter payout arc. Right, so I want something that's got whatever the prize pool is that's going to pay out about, let's say, 15 to 20% of the field. The industry standard is somewhere around 18%, right, for a normal tournament. If the tournament's got X to in the entire prize pool, I want 10% of that going to first place. I would love to see 10% of first place go to 9th or 10th place. So if, let's say, it's a $1 million tournament, I'd love to see $100,000 to first and $10,000 to 9th and or 10th place. So a flatter payout arc, it pays out about 18% of the people. So, like, if you come in second, you should not be wholly disappointed with your output in that tournament. You know, if you, I love the Millionaire Makers. I've played every single one, and one of my greatest DFS stories comes from one. And we've actually talked about it before. However, coming in second place in that thing felt like a loss. You know, and it shouldn't feel like a loss because it was my largest payday in daily fantasy to this point. I'm still going to enter and probably enter the maximum, the 150 entries in that gargantuan $3 Millie Maker in week one, but I'm doing it to try and bink the million because second place is like 10 times smaller than first.
And that sucks. So when you enter, and we'll get into this in a second too about multiple entries and things like that, how do you do the multiple entries? Do you do it by hand? Do you script it? Do you have a spreadsheet that you do? Because I know that there are many different ways that people come to try to build their cores and build teams around that. Do you have any specific style when it comes to building multiple entries?
A couple of years ago, and for two of the last three seasons, I essentially built all my lineups by hand. Last season when, you know, lineup builders came out on multiple sites, don't even have to name any of the ones that they did because basically everybody has them now. I kind of tried with the scripting aspect and tried to have the computer generate lineups for me based around the core that I was selecting. I could never get it to build lineups that I really liked. And as a result, I didn't perform as well in tournaments as I had in previous football seasons.
So
I think this year I'm going to go back to building all of my lineups by hand. If I have to make 100 or 150 lineups a week by hand, I'll do it.
So when you see a tournament, and are you focusing more on the higher stakes games, the lower stakes games, or do you try to play a few with the bunch? So if you have a lineup that hits big in a $100 entry or a $333 entry, that it could possibly do really well in a $3 entry or a $12 entry, or do you just stick to the high stakes?
To me, it just I'm trying to win a week when it comes to football. You know, there's only so many GPP slates that are out there that are realistic for you to be able to have enough variation in your core and in your contrarian plays from the field. Like when you get to the playoffs, there's like they're 4 or 8 game slates. You know, they're not really big slates, so you can't really differentiate that much. The percentage owned on the players is through the roof, so it's harder to get different from the crowd. you know, so that you can maybe have some different lineups from everybody else in the way that you're making things, but still have access to your core of good players that you want to, because you don't really need to be sub 5% at every position to have a chance to win. You know, the player who has the lowest combined percentage owned does not automatically win a tournament. And last year, like on our podcast, Daily Fantasy Edge, Adam broke down that basically every week the teams that were winning had like 3 or 4 or 5 players that were basically chalk plays, and they differentiated here or there, you know, one running back, one wide receiver, and maybe you know, their defense or their flex was different, and they hit all those spots, but the core was the core. So I want to take advantage of those bigger game slate weeks, you know, the 12 games, the 15 games, the 16 game weeks, where I can really take advantage of being able to differentiate at spots, having different quarterback and pass catcher combinations, different stacks possibly. You know, in football, you don't want to stack 4 players from a team, but you can stack 2 or 3 from one team and 2 from another team and have a game stack that other people may or may not have. So the combination of those players is less owned than other combinations of players. And to me, that gives you the best chance at finishing in first. So I want to make all my lineups. Let's say I make 50 or 100 lineups in a week. I want to win that one week. Because right now, if you basically have the nuts in any week of daily fantasy on DraftKings, you're without winning the Millie Maker. Let's say that tournament is way too big and you don't even bank the million there. But you win the $5, the $9, the $12, the $27, and the $100. You're going to win like $500,000 from those 5 or 6 tournaments. So I'm trying to win one out of the 17 weeks of the regular season.
So do you think that is the way that everyone should be looking at it, is that you have whatever bankroll that you have for the year, hopefully, you know, you don't lose it all week one, or
yeah,
you do proper bankroll management to make sure that you have some, but you're just trying to hit big in tournaments one of those weeks?
I mean, that's going to more than pay for your season. You know, it's going to pay for multiple seasons if you happen to bink a week. And players have done it in the past. A few years ago, Head Chopper did it. Mr. Tuttle has done it. Max Dullery, now Sahil Sood, has done it. Peter Jennings did it. I think it was week 3 last year, or week 5, whatever the you like that week was. You know, he was on Cousins and had him throughout all of his lineups, and he didn't win the Millie Maker, but he had a massive week in all the GPPs because that was the heart of his core.
Is there? You know? I was going to ask you: is there any like sort of tournament where you see whatever the max entries are, and you're like, "That's too many max entries. I don't want to play against a guy with like 500 lineups."
No, I'm less concerned with the amount of lineups that other people have, as long as it's a specific percentage of the field. Because, and I've taken this stance in live finals too. Obviously, those are much smaller fields, but the baseball final from last season comes to mind, where I think there were 100 entries and 35 or 40 of them were multiple entries. You know, where people had, I think 5 people or 6 people had 5 entries each. So that was 30% of the field right there. You know, and there were other people that had multiple entries. So it was something like 45 different contestants were in a 100-man tournament, but like half the field was multiple entries. So they were going to go and try and finish first or last. Or it was taking a Ricky Bobby outlook on it, right? And I wasn't just going in there trying to shake and bake. I was trying to finish as high as possible. So knowing that those guys were going to take differentiated shots, take chances on pitchers, stack totally different teams, which is kind of a win-it-all or lose-it-all mentality. You know, your team's going to score 10 runs, you're going to win. Or if the team that you stack scores 3, you're not going to win. That meant to me that at least 40 teams, I was coming in out of the 100, I was already in 60th place. So I just put in a cash game lineup and tried to finish as high as I could. I came in like 7th place. I think I won like $80,000 that tournament. Obviously, I didn't win the top prize, but I was basically 10 feet away from coming in 2nd in that one as well, which would have been $500,000. So I don't mind the multiple entry, because the more entries you put in, if you're varying from your core greatly, which is what a lot of players do. They try to, when they make multiple lineups, not everybody takes the approach of, this is my core, I'm going to play my core, and when my core hits, I'm going to have an absolutely monstrous week, come in 1st, 5th, 8th, 10th, right? They're saying, okay, I'm going to finish first, but then my next one's going to come in like 500th.
So can you break that down a little bit for people? Because I think it kind of goes over a lot of people's heads, and even to the point where you say build around your core. Let's say theoretically you build 100 lineups. How many guys would you have your top core in? Would you have them in all 100? Would it be 75%? Like, what's a reasonable level to have your core in?
I mean, that varies from player to player, and it matters to how much, you know, how much risk, how risk averse are you as a player? You know, how much risk do you want to take on? Obviously, the greater amount of exposure you have to a player, the more risk you're going to take on. I typically don't have more than 40 or 50% exposure to any one player, because if that player gets concussed in the first quarter of an NFL game, I don't want to just have to write off the entire week, because that's my level of risk aversion. I know that there are other players, great players, some of the top players in the world, who take an all or nothing stand on two or three players. They'll have 100% ownership. Sometimes they'll have 80% ownership, sometimes 75, but they're taking a huge stand on a player, not only versus the field, but in the way you look at their own lineups. If this doesn't pan out, if I'm wrong on this guy, I lose. You know, and we've joked with Peter Jennings, CSU Ram 88, about how he's going to have he's just going to make the maximum amount allowed of Andrew Luck lineups, because he's tied himself to Andrew Luck's wagon. If he's going to win another Millie Maker, he's got to do it with Andrew Luck. So he's going to make 150 Luck lineups. But, you know, the week that Luck throws for 5 touchdowns and runs for another and throws for 450, he's going to be in great shape, right? But if that week never happens, he's behind the eight ball. So I choose to vary my lineups a little bit more, because that much risk is just not palatable for me. But I know that there's very successful players who definitely go that route.
So if you weren't someone who builds 100 lineups, like I don't build 100 lineups, I usually build around like 15 or 20, and I know some people just play 5, or maybe they play 2 or 3. How does the strategy change in building your lineups with the fewer amount of lineups that you put in?
I mean, for me, I'm not building 100 totally ridiculously different lineups, right? So you get 3 wide receiver slots, 2 running back slots, a flex, obviously, right? Or you get 1 tight end spot. Some of my tournament lineups are going to have 2 tight ends in there. So let's say I'm going to pick 3 tight ends that I'm going to have heavy exposure to, and I'll probably have 2 others that, you know, maybe I like a little bit, and I'll have a little bit exposure. I'll pick 5 or 6 wide receivers. I'll pick 3 to 4 running backs that I really like. And I'll kind of cycle them through. If you letter the running backs A, B, C, D, so lineup 1 will have A, B, lineup 2 will have A, C, lineup 3 will have A, D, right? And just kind of pepper them through in that order. So I've got different combinations of my core sprinkled throughout that entire group of lineups. Now, I'm going to do that over 100 lineups, so let's say I'm going to pick 10 quarterbacks, and I'm going to make 10 of each quarterback, right? So I'm going to have 10 Andrew Luck lineups, 10 Rodgers lineups, 10 Derek Carr lineups, 10 Marcus Mariota lineups. I'm going to probably pair those guys with 1 and possibly 2 pass catchers in some of them, you know, of their 10 lineups that I'm making, because the best correlation between fantasy scoring is a quarterback to his pass catchers, right? And I'm going to cycle my core through those different quarterback pass catcher lineups. Now, I'm doing that 10 times for each one. If I'm going to make 10 to 20 lineups for a game, and I love the 3-max games. Those are some of my favorite games in baseball, NBA, and I'm really looking forward to them in football in terms of GPPs this season. If I'm making less lineups, I'm going to have less iterations of those quarterbacks. So if I'm making 20 lineups, I'm probably going to have, you know, 5, maybe 6 quarterbacks that I'm going to pick, and I'm going to do the same exact thing. I'm going to cycle my core through those lineups, you know, labeling them A, B, C, D, whatever, at the different positions, and make sure I have different combinations of those guys throughout my lineups. And I'm going to mix in, instead of 10 lineups with each quarterback, I'll make 2 with my favorite guy. I'll maybe make 3 or 4. But I'll just have less quarterbacks that I'm making and less lineups of each quarterback while still focusing on my core and quarterback pass catcher combinations.
All right, let's talk about the positions and how to target each one if you're trying to win one of these big GPPs. And the strategy, it seems, that a lot of people are employing this season, whether it's cash games, whether it is tournament play, whether it's season-long, is receivers are very valuable, running backs not so much. So when I talked to Drew about cash games, he said there's nothing more valuable than having that backup running back who's priced like a backup who ends up being a starter for the week. On DraftKings, he could be $3,100, and that just allows you so much flexibility in cash games to build the rest of your lineup. Now, he's the same price in GPPs, but how do you target the running back position? Is it wise to take one of the top-end guys knowing that people are always looking for values?
I mean, DraftKings is full-point PPR, so when you get that guy that's going to be 3 to 4K who's going to have massive amounts of volume, which is the first thing that I look for, is volume. Because talent is important. Talent is great. Speed is awesome. Size is awesome. All of those things are a player's skill set and their talent. But if that player can have that amount of, you know, that amount of talent and that specific skill set that looks fantastic, you know, in a combine sheet or on a, you know, on a piece of paper, if they're not getting the amount of targets, if they're not getting the amount of carries that they need, the amount of volume that I'm looking for, then I'm just not going to play them. If they don't have a path to it that week, you know, some players I expect to get an accelerated amount of targets or accelerated amount of carries that week or increased amount versus what their typical amount is. It still makes sense to go with, like I said before, playing the guys that look like the right plays, especially as we get later on in the season and have more data about who these teams are and who the defenses are that they're playing against, and we can more accurately project snap counts, target rates, carries. But yes, Drew is 100% right that, you know, the cheap running backs who are going to get a ton of volume are going to be very popular. And in week one, Thomas Rawls is still injured with this off-season ankle injury that he had, and right now it's questionable whether or not he'll be a full go for week one. And if he's not, Christine Michael will probably be the highest-owned player on DraftKings in week one because his salary is only $3,700, and DraftKings pricing is extremely tight.
So in a giant GPP, if you're playing in the Millionaire Maker knowing there's so many entries, is he then, does he become a player to avoid or a player to take? And it doesn't need to be him. It can be if there is a running back that is a great value that 45% of the people are going to have, even if it is the chalk, do you eat the chalk and then just try to fix your team elsewhere?
I don't think that there is a steadfast, hard and fast rule that you can make for that. And here's why. If you think that there is a reasonable path that this player is not going to perform and reach the amount of points that you need him to reach, if that percent, you know, that percent chance he's going to exceed whatever point total you think he needs at his price or at his ownership level, if that number does not exceed what you project his ownership to be, then fade the guy. If you think somebody's going to be 50% owned, so it's a binary decision, right? If he goes off, you have to have him. If he fails, then you had to fade him, right, to be successful that week. If you think that 75% of the time that guy is going to have 25 to 30 DraftKings points, then it does not make sense to fade him if only 50% of the crowd is going to be on him. Case in point, David Johnson from last year, when he first kind of got the job when Chris Johnson went down, and he was like 3,500 and was a stone-cold lock, was going to get 20 carries, was going to get 8 targets that week, you know, we projected, and the goal line work as well. And it turned out, if you didn't play him, if you faded him when he was 45 or 50% owned that week, you just weren't winning GPPs because he had 27 or 30 DraftKings points. So I don't think there's one hard and fast rule of, well, he's X percent owned and I must fade him. For me, I look at, okay, is the volume going to be there? What defense is he facing? What are the chances, in my opinion, that he scores X amount of points that I need him to score, you know, for the salary that he's at, and to be able to pallet this huge number of owners that are going to be on him? And if that percent is higher than the number of people that I think will be on him, then I'm just going to own the guy. I'm going to eat the chalk.
So at the rest of the, I mean, you mentioned volume, you mentioned goal line work and the opportunity that running backs have as the greatest predictor of success in daily fantasy. What else can we look at? What about spreads? What about game totals? Like, do you always try to look at the spreads and say, hey, this team is favored at home, the running back should have a good game script in this matchup?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of work done that shows that running backs at home, when they're favored by 6 or more points, have a greater expected fantasy output than those who are on the road when they're dogs. You know, so like, there's a lot of things that kind of line up, and I take them each kind of as they lay. There's not like hard and fast rules, but obviously, you know, a team that's going to play faster or play against a team that plays at a faster pace than they do will be getting extra snaps and will therefore, you know, have the opportunity to score more fantasy points, but they won't always score more fantasy points. Something else that a lot of people look at, well, this quarterback, and we were just talking about this on Twitter today, how Drew Brees has amazing home road splits, right? Like, he's amazing at home, thrown almost twice as many touchdowns, 50% more touchdowns in his home games over the last 3 years than he has in his road games over the last 3 years, with the same amount of interceptions and lower yards per game on the road than he does at home. The Saints are just a better team offensively in that dome. So the follow-up question was, okay, so that means I should play Mark Ingram on the road. And I said, no, there's a really high correlation as well between running backs' fantasy scoring and their team that scores a lot of points. Running backs score more points when their team is scoring a lot of points. When a team scores 14, the running back probably does not have a lot of points unless he luck boxes his way into the end zone from the one-yard line two times.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense when you think about it. And I get where the initial reaction to the other side of the coin is, but I know you're completely right. Yeah, if the Saints score, let's say, 38 points at home, it's unlikely that Drew Brees is going to be involved in all of them, and it just gives your back, if he is a goal line back, the more chances to touch the ball in the red zone. That's the opportunity that you're looking for.
And I know how much you love playing Mark Ingram.
This is true. Maybe one time this year I'm going to put him on a team. We'll see. Probably not. I've never actually used him in daily fantasy, which, you know, has
you
worked.
Probably should has, rectify that
no,
at some point this
don't
year.
Tell me what to do. It's my team. I will make my lineups how I deem fit, okay?
All right. Well, they play the Raiders in week one there, Pat.
All right, perfect. He's going to get -8 points. Everyone else can own him, and I'm just going to win. Everyone's going to end up with negative points in the Millionaire Maker, and I'll just be floating out there with, like, Latavius Murray on the other side. Probably not Latavius Murray, though. But are there any other tips or tricks at running back you can think of, or even say, how can I pick out a contrarian running back, one that's going to be lower owned and is actually a good play?
The pass-catching backs that don't play the huge volume are typically guys that are good GPP plays if you can pinpoint the right spot. Theo Riddick, Darren Sproles, last year Duke Johnson, though he should take on a larger role in that Browns offense this year. Guys like that who they don't think are going to be the bell cow guy come in at lower owned percentages, but again, full point per reception. So if these guys get in a situation where the lead back doesn't play, the game flow just lends itself to them having to pass more, and that pass-catching third down back is now on the field on first and or second down as well as third down, there's more opportunities for them to catch the ball. Sean Drawn was a guy like that as well last year, where there were some games that he caught 8-9 balls. And if you can pinpoint those weeks where you say they're in a situation where they're going to have to throw a ton this game, there's going to be a lot more targets, they're not going to be able to ride the big back, the between the tackles back, but they're going to be throwing the ball and a lot of swing passes, a lot of checkdowns. You can get a quality back at a much lower owned percentage, and you just got to hope that they score from outside of 10 yards, because once they get down to the goal line, they're going to bring that big back in once again.
What about on FanDuel then? Would you ever play the type of back that you just talked about in a FanDuel game, whether it be Theo Riddick, Charles Sims, Darren Sproles, Danny Woodhead, those type of players?
Less so, but situationally, yes, I will. You know, like, the price dictates that it kind of makes sense, and I think that I can get, you know, what's the number, 3 times their salary, 3 to 4 times their salary out of somebody sitting at, I don't know, 5 or 6K, and I think that they have a shot at 20 points. There were weeks that I played Deion Lewis last year over there because it just made sense to do so, because his price hadn't caught up to his projected role in the offense, even though he wasn't this, you know, he was more of a PPR back, at least in reputation.
Yeah, and the stats bear that out, too. I mean, I think he averaged something like, I don't know, 18 points a game in PPR as opposed to 13 in standard. That's a considerable difference on a week-to-week basis. All right, let's pump the brakes on DFS strategy for a second. Before we get to the rest of the positions, I need to let you know a little bit about Rocket Mortgage, or Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, as they would prefer it be called, which proudly supports the Pat Mayo Hour. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage approval process into the 21st century. Fast, powerful, and completely online, Rocket Mortgage has taken all the complicated, time-consuming parts of applying for a mortgage out of the equation. Do you hate searching through stacks of old files or paperwork? With Rocket Mortgage, you can easily share your bank statements and pay stubs at the touch of a button, helping you get approved in minutes for a custom mortgage solution that's been tailored to your financial situation. And even better, with Rocket Mortgage, you can do all this on your phone or tablet. It's a quick online process you can manage from the convenience of your couch. So, if you're looking to refinance your mortgage or buy a home, check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/mayo. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states and MLSconsumerAccess.org number 3030. Back to Al and DFS GPP wide receivers. Let's move to receivers. And again, when we talked about cash receivers, you know, the Julian Edelmans of the world on DraftKings tend to have a very high floor. They tend to be very consistent. Whereas DeSean Jackson or even Michael Floyd to an extent, Sammy Watkins are big play guys that can score a lot of fantasy points in a hurry, but can also let you down week to week. Are those the types of GPP and tournament style receivers that you want to sprinkle throughout your lineups?
Exactly, and one guy who really paid off in that aspect a lot last year, and are you sitting down? You're sitting down, right?
Always.
Okay. Ted Ginn was that guy
last year,
right? And he kind of makes you verp a little bit anytime you think about putting him in a roster, but, you know, you got to fight through that because those are the type of guys that can win a week for you if they catch those two long touchdown passes, and there will be players this year who will catch those two long touchdown passes, or at least one and maybe another big catch. And a guy who's moved into more PPR, more consistent targets is Dante Moncrief this season, right? But a couple of years ago, he had a huge game where he had like two touchdowns, three catches, over 100 yards on four targets.
That just sounds
something ridiculous like that, but if you didn't have him on your lineup, you weren't competing for GPPs that week.
That happened last year, too. It was either week one or week two with Travis Benjamin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
it's going to happen. It happened with Ted Ginn when he was really low-owned, and he was the fourth wide receiver on the depth chart for Carolina, and he had, like, two touchdowns in the first half for 120 yards. And guess what? If you didn't have him at 3K or 3.5, and he was less than 5% owned, if you were the guy that had the foresight to say that the cornerback that they're facing, this is where they're going to go because the defense they're facing is strong at these other positions, they're going to take away that and make Ted Ginn beat him. If you can project that guy from week to week, and you're not going to be able to project that guy every week, but you don't have to do it every week to be solid at GPPs. Like I said, if you can be the guy who picks the right lineup one week and you have it in multiple tournaments across different buy-in levels, you have the chance to win, you know, between a quarter and three-quarters of $1 million on DraftKings any weekend this year.
When we are starting with receivers, where do you start your lineups? Do you start with quarterbacks and build your lineups down because you say, I want to have these 10 quarterbacks, I'll work it out from here? Or do you say, hey, these are the receivers that I want as a part of my core, and then I'll start structuring my teams around that?
I don't start by position, really. I start with the price inefficiencies, at least in terms of – I always start with my cash game lineup. So I start with the price inefficiencies, and I build that lineup. These are the guys who they're just priced wrong, and I just have to have them, kind of like what you were saying that Drew and you were talking about, where these guys, based on injury or change in role or suspension or whatever has happened, these guys are now at a discount for what their volume projects to be and what we project their scoring as a result to be. This gives us the best value. So I plug those guys in first. I always start with the value. And then I find the stud players that I feel I must have that week. And then I fill in with the mid-range guys. You know, the leftovers are going to be the three or four mid-range guys that I have to fill in who I think have the best matchup and the most projectable volume. And then off of that core, that main lineup, that kind of feeds me my core, right? That's my main core. And then I'll pick two or three other guys that just missed the cut on that cash game lineup. That becomes my GPP core. And then, as we spoke about before, I will try and cycle them through multiple different lineups.
Is there any merit to the theory of identifying who the players that everyone else is on? So let's say in week one, this probably is not going to be the case, but you're going to have your top three guys. You're going to have Brown, you're going to have Julio, and you're going to have Beckham. And people are going to look at it. People are going to write articles, and it's going to come out, you know what? People really like Brown. People really like Julio, and they're kind of down on Beckham. is there a way where you could just play it and try to figure out these things every single week and just take the guy that is the lower owned, but is still going to get the volume and just may not be in the right matchup?
100%. You want to know how to do it?
Okay.
Find consensus rankings, and there's sites that put them out. I think Fantasy Pros does it, where they get experts from all the different sites, you know, from everywhere, from ESPN, from Yahoo, from FNTSY, from Roto Experts, from everywhere, right? And they get their rankings for the week, and then they put up a consensus. This is what the industry feels is the top, you know, 30 quarterbacks, running backs, wide receivers, etc. Cross off the top three quarterbacks, cross off the top three from every position. And all of a sudden, now you're building contrarian lineups, but you're not being stupid. Because the fourth quarterback is still in an excellent situation that week, facing a weak defense, and is somebody who gets a lot of volume. But as a result of the consensus rankings usually having some correlation with the percentage owned in tournaments, you're eliminating the guys who are, you know, 40% owned, 30% owned, 25% owned. So now your highest guys are going to be 17. And you're building lineups that are still based on stars who have great matchups and are getting great volume. However, they're going to be less owned than the most popular kid in the school that week.
When we switch to QBs, and you mentioned that you can stack your lineup with a quarterback and a receiver or two from their team, probably not three though, right?
Rarely.
So what do you do? Do you have to have that in GPP play?
No. I mean, like I said, there's no hard and fast rules to GPP play. That's why I like it, because you get to be creative. You know, cash games, there are more rules in cash games. Like you can look at a cash game lineup and go, this is a bad lineup. It's harder to do that in a GPP. Yes, it can be done. You know, you see somebody's GPP lineup, and they have a quarterback and a running back against their defense, and the defense returns two touchdowns, and, you know, the quarterback puts up a ton of yards, and all of a sudden they're winning a GPP with a terribly constructed lineup. But it's a GPP, and there's less rules involved, I guess. You're just trying to score the most points. And that can happen in a myriad of ways. Obviously, they're giving themselves the lowest percentage chance to be able to do that. But if you kind of just stick to those basic rules of stuff that makes sense, you know, these things work with these other things, and you can break them slightly, you know, then you can go about your business in that way. Another way, and I just spoke about this on another pod, was, you know, there's a correlation matrix that's been going around. RotoViz is the site that put it out originally, and it shows kind of the correlation between different positions in fantasy scoring. So, like, you know, the quarterback from Team A versus the quarterback from Team B, what's their correlation? Quarterback from Team A and the wide receiver 1 from Team A, the wide receiver 2 from Team A, quarterback to running back. And you can look at every different relationship from all the different fantasy players on both sides and how they relate to one another. The flaw in that, because some people are married to that chart, the flaw in that chart, if there is one, is that it includes everything. It includes every running back, every quarterback, every wide receiver, and their opponent from every game in their sample set. There are outliers, because quarterback, running back, wide receiver together is a bad correlation. Or running back to wide receiver is a bad correlation. However, situationally, it's not. If you look at the Steelers for the past couple of seasons, when Le'Veon Bell is healthy and Antonio Brown is on the field, you can most certainly play the two of them together in the same lineup, because they're outliers versus the chart. The chart's going to give you the bell curve. So you can take a look at that and say, okay, well, everybody's going to shy away from this, and they're not going to do it. You know, a good GPP strategy is, you know, have the testicular fortitude to do what your opponents will not do. And many opponents will not play a running back and a wide receiver from the same team. But as we saw last year, Bell and Brown, you can play them together. That's been for the last 2 years. Last year, Devontae Freeman and Julio Jones were both getting enough volume. You know, the Freeman for a good stretch was getting 30-plus touches a game, catches plus attempts, or targets plus attempts. And Julio Jones was getting 12 to 14 targets a game. And there was enough volume to play both of them together. However, the total percentage of teams in a GPP that was making that move was exceptionally low. And in my opinion, it's a result of, well, I can't play the wide receiver and the running back from the same team. So if you're willing to do that situationally and kind of break the rules, but do them in the right way, do it in a way that kind of makes sense in terms of projectable volume, then you can separate yourself from the field by breaking the rules, but not really breaking the rules.
Are you someone who normally pays up or down at quarterback, or do you just do it on a week-by-week basis in GPPs?
Last season and the season before, I don't want to pay up at quarterback, but I get sucked into doing it way too often. You know, I just said, well, I can totally afford him. If I just change this one guy out, I can afford Tom Brady. The right move for the last 2 years has been to have the cheaper quarterbacks. Now, in week one, on DraftKings, the quarterback pricing is way up from where it was last year. You know, last year, you could find a lot of guys between 5,200 and 6,200 that were, you know, great plays at quarterback, that were going to have a possibility of putting up 20 fantasy points, and the top players, you know, Cam Newton or Tom Brady were somewhere between 7,500 and 8,500. So like, you could use that extra 2K to bump a mid-range guy up to an all-pro. You know, and they've kind of rectified that. It's making it tougher. But there are still some plays that are in the, let's say, the mid to low 6K range that are definitely in play at least early in the season, at least in week one. That's all we know about so far. So I'm still going to try and dial back at quarterback so I can pay up at other positions where the volume is a little bit more predictable, and the differentiation in scoring between the top three running backs or wide receivers is way different from the 15th wide receiver, where the difference between the top two or three quarterbacks isn't always that much different from the 10th best quarterback.
How does Vegas totals play into wide receivers and quarterbacks? I mean, we talked about spreads, home favorites for running backs, showing a correlation between fantasy success. Is it team totals? Is it game totals? Or is there no correlation between these numbers and what quarterbacks and wide receivers do?
I mean, I think that they're both tied to pace, and if you kind of look at both as complementary, then it can lead you to a little bit more predictable outcomes. I want to see teams that are playing quickly, teams are going to, where the quarterbacks are going to have to throw the ball a ton. If you project a quarterback to throw for a lot of yards, somebody has to be on the other end of all of those throws. And a lot of the time it comes down to where the ball is going to go. There's certain offenses that funnel the ball to certain places. There are also certain defenses that make an offense funnel the ball to a specific place. You know, like the Seattle Seahawks. You cannot choose outside wide receivers against the Seahawks. And typically, people just avoid playing all wide receivers against the Seahawks. However, the interior of that pass defense is not as good. You can choose slot receivers and you can pick tight ends against Seattle. But I'm not going to go up against Richard Sherman on the outside. And I'm not going to take the guy on the other side of the field either. I'm going to go with the slot wide receiver or the tight end against them, because that's where they're funneling the ball with their defense. And other opposing offensive coordinators know that, and they comply. Okay, they'll take the path of least resistance. You're not going to let me throw it outside. We'll try and move the chains inside, which is going to lead to more targets, therefore more catches, more volume, as well as the fact that they're low ADOT targets. They're closer to the line of scrimmage. They're easier to turn into catches.
Do you have a preference between running quarterbacks or no?
I have a preference if the quarterback is actually going to be running the ball around the goal line. So I'm more likely to want to play Cam Newton than I am maybe Tyrod Taylor.
Or Jameis.
Although I loved playing Tyrod Taylor last season, early in the year, but he just doesn't get the call inside the 10-yard line, which I think is just terrible from, I mean, I'm not an offensive coordinator, I'm not trying to do anybody else's job, obviously. But it seems that if you have a player with a specific skill set, and you make that player a threat in a small area of the field, specifically a running quarterback, if you just let him run the ball, give him some attempts, move him outside the pocket, and make him running a threat, they have to assign defenders to at least be aware of that. But the Bills did not run Tyrod Taylor inside the five last year, but a couple of times. So if that changes, I'll be more on Tyrod Taylor this year. If not, you kind of have to rely on him as a passer and running the ball between the 20s without the huge upside of him running in a touchdown from inside the five like you can with Cam Newton, Andrew Luck, Aaron Rodgers, other guys of that nature.
What do we do at tight end? Because, and this is another thing that Drew and I talked about for cash, where it was like, oh yeah, just put in Gronk and you'll be fine, figure out the rest from there. And that didn't really play itself out last year to be super successful. So in GPP play, are you looking for a high volume type of tight end that can get you a baseline in points and maybe earn 4 or 5 times the salary? Or do you take those shots on the $2,500 on DraftKings or $3,000 guy that you think is on a team that could be in the red zone a lot and they are a red zone threat?
This seems like the old stewardess joke of, you know, coffee, tea, or milk. Yes. there are some weeks that I'm going to want to pay up for Rob Gronkowski. Week one will probably not be one of those weeks, as he's priced at $7,400, which is 50% more than the number two tight end on the pricing. So for me, he's kind of out. Although it may be a good week to play him, you know, just because his percentage is going to be so low and they don't have that many targets. And if they get into the red zone, you know, they should be getting the ball in his direction more often than not, but to pay up for that is really restrictive in week one on DraftKings. However, there are a lot of players that do project to get a lot of targets at lower prices, like, you know, Kobe Fleener for the Saints at $4,900 against Oakland looks like a great play. Delanie Walker averaged over 8 targets a game last year as well. He's lower priced. And then, like you said, there's guys that are cheaper as well. Will Ty, Clive Walford, if you're looking for just an end zone guy, Jared Cook moving to Green Bay, and should everybody hates him, and I don't disagree, but he's never played with a good quarterback or been the number one guy in an actually good offense with an actually good quarterback who utilizes his tight end.
He's the Mark Ingram of tight ends.
Yeah, you know what you got to do though. You got to make a team with both of them.
Oh no, I don't know if I can handle that. I mean, I would gladly accept the money if it won for me, but I don't know if I just making it. I don't know if my
you would just hate yourself all week. It would be like watching the. You know what it would be? It would be the DFS version of watching the last season of Entourage. You would just be hate watching your lineup all week.
How about like the last 4 seasons? Didn't Entourage end up going on for like 8 years?
I don't. The last season or two, like you were only watching the last season or two because you had spent so much time watching the first bunch of seasons, and you just needed to see how it ended. So we all were just hate watching it by the end of it.
Oh, I remember hate watching it, and I feel like it went on for years.
They started a tequila company.
Oh yeah, with Mark Cuban.
Yeah, Mark Cuban was there.
Fun times. Defenses. Now, you turned me on to this last year with the double dip move of pairing the either receiver or running back, generally a receiver, that is actually doing things as a receiver who also returns punts, and pairing it with that defense. Is that something that you do in a lot of your lineups or just a few?
It depends on the receiver. Now, if the receiver is somebody who's actually getting volume with the offense, and hello, Tyler Lockett, I am probably going to build some Seattle to Tyler Lockett combo lineups there, because in the case that he returns a punt for a touchdown and receives a touchdown in that week and gets his, let's say he gets 4 receptions for 80 yards and a touchdown, returns a punt for a touchdown, you get those extra bonus points. You get the 6 points for the defense and special teams returning it, as well as the 6 points for Tyler Lockett, and we call that the hashtag double dip. It's been trademarked. Don't even think about stealing it.
Hey, I made it onto a board last year when you told me.
We licensed that out to you.
Okay, good. have I renewed that license for this year? Because I've already made
it. Yes, you've renewed the license for 2016. 2017 is pending. The price will change.
I don't know if I can afford that. I might just have to do it in my lineups and not tell anyone about it because I can no longer. Maybe it will work so well, I will be able to afford it. How about that?
See, that's, you know why? Because you're going to win $1 million playing Jared Cook and Mark Ingram in one lineup with a double dip with Lockett and the Seattle Seahawks defense.
Well, now you're just making my week one lineup
for
me. Now I have to make this lineup.
It's actually a pretty good lineup.
Anything home, I don't know about that. But is there any other defensive tricks you can think of? Because I know a lot of people want to take, oh, Seattle's a shutdown defense. They're going to shut down the other team. But when I pick my defenses, I tend to pick, you know, some closer games. And you always mention pace for a lot of these things. I like to play teams that have a high pace of play, giving me more opportunities for sacks, for interceptions, for fumbles, and potentially getting that all-valuable score that you need. Now, do you do it the same way, or are you looking for shutdown Ds?
I'm not looking for shutdown or pace. I'm looking for – because I'm not trying to get the shutout. Shutouts are so
rare.
Few and far between. Yeah, it's just that they just don't happen that much in today's NFL. So, like, playing for the shutout, I'm going to get that 10 points for the shutout. In fact, wasn't the most predictable shutout when, like, the Seahawks were at home against, like, the Rams last year or whoever it was, and everybody was on the Seahawks defense, and they got zero sacks, and they got zero interceptions and zero fumbles. They just got their 10 points for the shutout, and they were, like, 50% owned. It's like, okay, they did all right, but they weren't winning you any GPPs because they didn't do what we all thought they were going to. So the one thing that I look for is pressure in the backfield. I want teams that can create pressure on the quarterback and create hits in the backfield on designed run plays, because the greatest predictor of turnovers is pressure on the quarterback. Hurried throws, especially to the outside, turn into interceptions, and the ones to the outside typically will turn into pick sixes. Sacks can turn into fumbles, which turn into a fat guy touchdown. Pick it up, scoop it up, big man, and run down the field, rumble. We all like seeing that on every replay show for the week. So that's my biggest predictor. I want teams that are going to put a lot of pressure on the quarterback. Last year I was targeting Seattle a lot, I was targeting the Bengals a lot, and I was targeting the Cardinals a lot. All of those teams put a ton of pressure in the backfield. They also had solid kick return games, and because they're putting that pressure on the quarterback, they had really good turnover rates as well.
Is this a nice way to differentiate your team and maybe take some shots? Like, do you want to have a core defense that if you built the 100 lineups, you'd want to have on 40%? Or is this a spot almost like quarterbacks to go like 10, 10, 10, 10?
I typically will pick two or three defenses and just roll with them.
Okay.
You know, again, I don't know if that's right or wrong. It's just what I do, and it's worked for me.
Anything to give on kickers for FanDuel for GPPs?
I pick the cheapest kicker with the highest total. I spend literally zero time on my kickers. And I know there's people that spend a lot of – there's good players that spend a lot of time on their kickers, and they do kicker research, and every once in a while they find the guy that gets 18 kicker points, and they say, see, all the research paid off. But what about the weeks where everybody has, like, you know, like the low guy has between 9 and 12 points, and you're just fine?
Yeah, I mean,
you know, realistically speaking, the kicker's not going to win you or lose you the week.
He could win you a week.
Three touchdowns. Not really.
I mean, we've seen, like, what was it, the Rob Barona 7 field goal game? I feel like that's helping out.
Right, and I've been playing for 4 years, and that's happened one time.
Okay.
So, you know, like, that's a 1 in 50 thing, and if you're on him, congratulations. You know, like, with kickers, I look for guys that I can pallet, guys that are kicking, hopefully a guy that's indoors, there's not a lot of wind if they're outdoors, on a good offensive team that has a solid enough total that's cheap.
Oh, last thing I did want to say, and or ask you at least, in terms of contrarian plays, how important is it to pick on guys that might be, you know, slightly injured, or people are not sure about their status or something like that? Because I find that usually leads to a very low ownership, although it is kind of risky.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this goes back to how risk-averse are you.
Very.
You know, if there's people that are sliding off of somebody, it's obviously going to knock down their percentage owned. If you think that they're going to be just fine, if all your intel says that they're just fine, then go ahead and roll with them. What happens is when a player is waiting for actives and inactives, right? Let's say it's one of those guys, where all week they don't know if that player, it's a good play, but they don't know if he's going to be active that week, and you don't find out until 2 or 3 hours before the games, right? So when that active and inactive report comes out, and this player is suddenly in, and it was like a 50-50, they were going to try him out before the game, his percent is going to be much lower that week. So if they're ready to go, they're probably ready to go, and we'll usually see the volume that they typically see, but their percentage own number will be much lower than it would have if there was no news at all.
So, yeah, and I feel like targeting those guys, I mean, you say for the risk-averse people, maybe they don't want to do it, but I feel like from everything that we've talked about here, it's about trying to win big. And if you can isolate a player that is highly talented, that can give you the volume that you need, that you can just this reason only. Yeah, maybe he leaves after 2 series with an ankle injury because his bum ankle acted up. But I feel like it's worth that risk if it's an elite player, especially, that you can just get down ownership on.
Of course. I mean, look, it's football. Everybody is one play away from being out for the day. It's happened to all of us, and I don't mean to, like, you know, pour lemon juice in anybody's wounds, but it happened to great plays last year who had no injury reports coming into the week, like Le'Veon Bell. You know, and he was extremely heavily owned, and he just got hurt early in the game.
I remember the Charkandrick West week, too.
Yeah, you're drawing dead if that happens. And there's it's happened to every. It happened to Jamaal Charles as well. And there's nothing you can do about it. So saying, well, I'm not going to put myself in that position by not selecting this player, in my opinion, if a player projects to play and they're going to make him active and not use him as a decoy, which does happen sometimes, like, oh, he's going to play and they just don't throw him the ball at all because he's just out there to be a decoy, that's a different situation. But if they say if he's going to go, he's going to be 100%, and they say he's going to go, then trust that he's going to go.
Is there any final tip that you think that we haven't touched on that we should?
I don't know. I think we hit an awful lot of topics here.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, the biggest tip to me would be stay within yourself. Stay within your bankroll. Don't overextend yourself. You know, figure out what you want to spend on GPPs and qualifiers for the entire season before week one starts.
No one's going to do that, by the way.
But at least I said it.
I know, but I get that people should, and I recommend doing it too. And I say it on the show, and the guests say it on the show, but even I have problems doing that myself. Do you?
Right, but if you go into the year and you say, okay, well, I kind of know what I'm going to spend every week. If you say, okay, week one, I'm going to spend this, and this is what I'm going to spend every week on GPPs, right? You know, I'm going to play this many lineups in this tournament, this many lineups in this tournament, this many lineups. Figure out what your spend is, and if you're comfortable with that, and you can multiply that by 17, and you're cool, then that's what you're going to spend. Otherwise, you're just going to burn through your bankroll in the first month and be done if you don't bink something early.
How important is it to diversify your risk in GPPs or between GPPs and cash games?
What do you mean diversify your risk versus playing cash games?
Like, okay, so if you play, I mean, Drew mentioned something like you should be playing, you know, 70% cash games, 30%
right.
GPPs. I know people that do that the opposite, don't play any cash games, but they play a different series of tournaments, just some bigger tournaments, some lower tournaments, just to give yourself a bunch of different shots. What do you think is a realistic expectation between GPPs and cash games?
It's going to vary from player to player, and it's also going to vary based on what is your goal for playing. You know, you need to figure out for yourself, and everybody's going to be different, why are you playing this game? Are you playing the game to pay your rent, to pay your mortgage, to pay your car note, to put food on your table? Then you're probably going to want to take a different approach than somebody who's playing for entertainment's sake, and I want to put in, you know, 1 to 10 lineups in the Millie Maker because I just want to have some fantasy football fun on the weekend on Sunday and possibly Monday night. Then they're going to have different angles of how they're going to play it. You know, I have no problem with somebody who's going at it from an entertainment standpoint and saying, I'm going to put some money, because this is my entertainment budget for the week in my own personal life, and I'm going to put it just in the Millie Maker because that's what I want to play. I want to try and turn my fandom of football into $1 million. And while that may be a negative EV play from a, you know, from somebody who's trying to look at it from a bankroll perspective, from an entertainment perspective, for that person, it's plus EV because they just want, their value is in the entertainment. So I have no problem with that if that's how you're playing. But if that's how you're playing and you're saying, well, look, I need to put food on the table and I'm going to put 100% of my weekly spend into tournaments that are very tough to turn a profit from, that's probably not the best idea. So if you're trying to grind up a bankroll and you're trying to build it from week 1 to week 17 and have more in week 17 than you started with in week 1 because that's how you must play, because the money that you have in your bankroll is what you have to play, and you're not going to redeposit and it's not entertainment for you, it's more of a supplement to your income, then you're going to want to take a 70-30 or an 80-20 approach with maybe no more than 10 or 15% of your bankroll in play. Of your total bankroll in play on any one week so that you don't run the risk of ruin. You know, you're going to live to fight another day in the case that you either pick players that don't perform or you get unlucky and your players just kind of go into the concussion protocol early.
Where can we find out all your work right now? I know the DFS Daily Fantasy Edge is back, and I've been listening, so that's good. Are you doing anything else besides that podcast now? And if so, tell us where we can find it.
Well, I am going to be contributing on ESPN during football season with some articles.
Big,
maybe
fancy
some other
ESPN.
Stuff as well.
Oh, I'm out. I write for ESPN.
I have the DFS Edge podcast. I've just started a kind of a new thing on my Twitch channel where I find somebody in the industry, a known name. Mike Leone is going to be on in one of the next couple of weeks with me, and I play a video game of their choice.
Never heard of him.
and we talked two hats, one mic. You haven't heard of this guy? And we talk about fantasy football while playing a video game of their choice, and I'm calling that one Stick to Sports.
That's a pretty cool concept.
I think it's kind of fun. We did the first one yesterday with J.J. Zacharyson from Number Fire, and we had a good time. So if you subscribe to my Twitch channel, it's twitch.tv/Al_Smizzle. You can find that.
If I knew what Twitch was, I would definitely sign up for that, I think.
Totally a website.
Oh, it's just a website. That's perfect. It's not like
just
an app.
It's a website.
It's not an app I have to download?
It is also an app.
Oh.
You could do one or the other and consume my content in either way.
Well, I think I might have to go check this out now. So, twitch.com. What was the username again?
Twitch.tv.
Okay.
/Al_Smizzle.
I'm there. I'm going to go check that
out.
There you go. I'm going to subscribe, get you the numbers up, because I got to figure out what this Twitch TV thing is. I hear all the video game guy people at work, like all the esports guys, they're all over it all day long.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a mixture between that. It's the fantasy sports and video game version of Jerry Seinfeld's Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee.
See, that is like the one line pitch that really sold it for me, I think.
See? I know what I'm doing here.
Listen, I don't dispute you know what you're doing, but that's a very good one.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Maybe we can get you on there to play some NHL one day.
Oh, good God, no. NHL. I don't play video games. They're just props behind me. If we can play,
you should play them.
If we can play, why? Why should I be playing this?
Because it's fun.
I have my fun doing other things, like finding like backdoor blackjack games that I can play when I'm walking home from work. That's fun.
All right, well, that is also fun, I assume. I've never done that.
I mean, if you've never been in an alley shooting dice or chucking bones. I know, weirdly enough, coming from me, it doesn't seem like something I would do, but I do, and it is a lot of fun.
Yeah, hey. If you can find, you know, Ashy Larry, then go have a game.
Just always have a good lookout guy in case, you know.
Yeah, you do need the lookout.
Gotta have the lookout guy. That's really essential. Anyway, Al, I've taken up way too much of your time. Thank you for being on. You can follow Al on Twitter @AlZeidenfeld, and you can follow me @ThePME. And remember to subscribe to the Pat Mayo Hour on YouTube and iTunes and Stitcher and Podomatic. Maybe even Twitch someday. Who knows? I'm Pat Mayo. I'll see you next time.